Support for WKAR is provided by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We do want to acknowledge the family, friends, and co-workers of Sandy Allen this morning. Sandy served on the Lansing City Council from 94 to 09 and passed away yesterday at the age of 76. She became a fixture in Lansing City government over her four terms on the council. Mayor Virge Bernero issued a statement yesterday and commented, and I quote here, "Few cared more and showed it more often than Sandy." Sandy Allen has passed away at the age of 76. Services Friday morning in downtown Lansing. For close to 20 years, Michigan State University researchers have polled state residents annually for the State of the State survey. The poll takes Michigan's pulse on some of the biggest issues in the news, and the results from the latest survey are now in. They measure support, or the lack thereof, for right to work, Governor Snyder and President Obama. They also ask questions aimed at measuring consumer confidence and the like. Happy to welcome back to Current State the director of the State of the State Survey, MSU Economics Professor Charlie Ballard. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Are you like a CPA on April 16th? You're relieved that you gave birth to another State of the State survey?
Well, relieved and exhilarated. We do four surveys a year. It is a big operation. I have to tell you that I'm sort of the tip of a very large iceberg. We've got a project manager, Graham Pierce. He does an awful lot of the programming work, and then it's a phone interview survey. So we've got a small army of folks who are in a call lab in Berkey Hall here on the MSU campus, and many of them are students, but not all, and they sit in front of a computer screen and they make phone calls and ask people all these questions.
Okay. Remind our listeners whose opinions these are.
This is Michigan adults. And so every quarter we aim for a survey of about 1,000, which is big enough to give you pretty good statistical properties, 1,000 Michigan adults. So to be in the survey, you have to be 18 years or over. And if a four-year-old answers the phone, we ask to talk to mom and dad. We do various statistical things to make sure that what we've got is as close as we can come to having a real, true, random sample of the Michigan adult population.
And the when were these phone calls made?
From the middle of January to early March.
All right, very good. And that happens four times a
year.
That
happens four times a year. Our next one is going to be going into the field in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Before we get into these survey results, you did release some findings late last week regarding attitudes toward right to work. Briefly remind us what those numbers suggest.
Well, what they suggest to me is that the public is almost exactly evenly divided. We asked the question, what do you think it'll do to the economy? Will it help, hurt, or have no effect?
Mm-hmm.
42.7% said they thought it would help. 41% said they thought it would hurt. And the rest said they thought it would have no effect. Well, if you look at that 42.7 and 41, those are within the margin of error for a survey of this size. And so basically, it's a statistical dead heat. It's a tie.
Mm-hmm.
And that suggests to me that probably we have not heard the last of right to work. It's going to be a contentious issue going forward, I would imagine.
How have writers of letters to the editor and politicians and other interest groups responded to your to the right to work numbers? Has there been a noticeable response to those?
I don't necessarily track all of the stuff. A lot of the public response in the press has been just to people who – let me start over. Boy, I'm stumbling over my words here. I think those who are in favor of right to work say, oh, yeah, look at this. And those who are opposed say, yeah, but look at this. And for instance, one organization that tends to favor right to work, they had a story earlier this week where they said 43% in favor, 16% neutral. Look at that. 59% say it won't hurt.
The Mackinac Center.
Yes.
Here you're Jack Spencer at the Mackinac Center, and they kind of took you to task for that.
They did somewhat. Of course, my response to that would be if you're anti-right to work, you could say, look, 57% said it won't help. counting the neutral category as being in favor of your thing, I sort of disagree with.
So depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on, you tend to take away different results.
I think that's almost always true.
Yeah. Well, you also measured approval and disapproval ratings for Governor Rick Snyder. How do the governor's numbers look?
We ask people to say excellent, good, fair, or poor. And I typically combine the excellent and the good into a favorable rating. And his favorables in our latest survey are 34%. Now, that's down very slightly from 35.5% last fall.
That's the excellent and the good?
That's the excellent and the good. He's got about 7% excellent, about 27% good. And that adds up to about 34% in the favorable category. That's down from 35.5% favorable in our previous survey last fall. But that's a very small change, and it's not statistically meaningful. In fact, the last four surveys in a row, the governor has been in the mid-30s.
Still, there is an election next year. What does a 34% favorability rating suggest for a candidate who presumably wants to be governor another term?
Well, certainly it's not as good as probably the governor would like to see if he's going to be reelected.
I imagine.
These are sort of not... They're not terrible. We've seen terrible. George W. Bush late in his term and Jennifer Granholm late in her term had numbers in the teens. So 34% is way better than that, but it's not a fabulous number.
Anything else to say about the response to Rick Snyder then?
Well,
is that the big takeaway?
I think that's the big takeaway, that his numbers have been in the mid-30s for more than a year now. And another takeaway, I think, is, and this is probably not a surprise, his support is stronger in West Michigan than in the Southeast.
Okay. Is there a geographic dynamic to your results? Are things weighted geographically in some way?
Well, we do various weightings, but we don't do a weighting on the basis of geography. But we do know the county of residence of everybody. And so when I get the results, I can say, okay, let's look at Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb County, which is sort of the core of the Detroit metro area. Or I can say, let's look at Kent County and the surrounding counties, which is sort of Grand Rapids and West Michigan. We do find on a whole host of issues, West Michigan more conservative than the Southeast.
Let's stay with Michigan issues before we look at attitudes toward President Obama. Regarding consumer confidence in Michigan, break that down for us.
We ask a bunch of questions about people's household financial situation. And one of them is, what's your current situation? And we give excellent, good, fair, not so good, and poor. And again, I like to focus on the excellent and good, because those are the sort of pretty good, favorable conditions.
You could interpret that as an endorsement, I suppose, right? Excellent and good.
Excellent and good. Those are in the plus category, whereas not so good or fair or poor, those are not in the plus category. We had more than 52% said that they were either excellent or good, and that's up from our previous survey, but that one was down from the one before. So what we've seen is those numbers were terrible in 2009, and then they've gradually come back up, and now we're sort of bouncing around in the high 40s and low 50s. decent, not as good as they were back in 1999.
How bad did it get in 2009? That was the depth of the Great Recession. Do you remember?
Let me see. We were down in the low 40s and even the high 30s in 2009.
Okay. And we're at 52 now.
We're at 52.6 now.
Okay.
So solid improvement. Interestingly, of the people who said their condition was poor, 2% of those who have incomes over $100,000 a year said their situation was poor. Now, most of them said that their situation was good. But the fact that some folks with incomes over $100,000 a year said they're poor, and there was one respondent with income below $20,000 who characterized his or her situation as excellent. So it does tell you that, you know, we don't do a focus group. We don't ask you, why did you say excellent? Why did you say poor? We just ask, and I think it tells you that a lot of people, their responses to these questions are based not on what the average citizen would expect, but on what their expectations are.
As a man thinketh, so is he.
That's right. I guess if you've been making millions and now you're only making $100,000, that's a problem.
How will I ever get by?
Yeah, exactly.
And where is Michigan with regard to President Obama?
The president's ratings actually took a bump up. He came to office in 2009 with a big burst of enthusiasm, and in his first survey after he took office, he was above 70% favorable. I don't think any of us thought that could be sustained, and it wasn't. And he dropped into the low 40s and had been in the low 40s for quite some time and was between 42 and 43% in our last survey. This last one, he's up at 48.4%, and that's a statistically significant increase between fall of 2012 and winter of 2013. I think it may be a sort of a reaction or a reflection of his victory, his successful reelection campaign, where, of course, he carried Michigan by almost a double-digit margin over Governor Romney.
We've already started to anticipate the election next year. Do you ask any questions involving prospective political candidates?
Not in this survey. We probably and not in our next survey. But when we get closer to the gubernatorial election, we're going to think very hard about asking some questions.
Gubernatorial candidates, Senate candidates.
Senate candidates, yeah, sure. Yeah, we've got 2014 is going to be a very, very interesting election year in Michigan.
Now, how will you determine what names to put on that to put in your questions?
Well, that's a really...
You could tell me, but you'd have to kill me.
That's hard. And of course, what we know is that the names that you put in early on may not be the names that actually are in the final general election. After all, if you had asked people in 2007, I mean, everybody knew that the 2008 presidential election was going to be between Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani. I mean, that was what everybody
baked in the cake.
Yeah, that was just hardwired.
It also raises a very interesting question as to whether or not your questions, if you were to have asked a question, do you favor Gary Peters for the U.S. Senate seat for amongst the Democrats in 2014 to replace Carl Levin? In a way, you end up playing a role in getting people to think about Gary Peters or anybody.
That's why we don't want the State of the State survey to be a political push-pull. It's an academic survey research. Most of our clients are MSU researchers who have used the data to publish articles in peer-reviewed journals, and we've also had clients like the Michigan College Access Network and the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation and Michigan Nonprofit Association and others. So we are not primarily a political polling operation.
Right.
We're an academic survey research, but we do also ask these other questions. And so we are thinking about whether to have questions like that. You know, would you support Gary Peters? But we're going to be very careful, and I'm not going to make any guarantees that we'll have questions like that on a future survey.
Mm-hmm. How often are you genuinely surprised by a number that pops up?
Less than I used to be, because now I've had several years of delving deeply into these data, but still, there are lots of surprises. It's not like I have some crystal ball that can predict exactly what these numbers are going to be. Sometimes we'll get a bump in the governor's ratings or the president's ratings that did surprise me. So sometimes I'm surprised. A lot of the times I'm not. I mean, many of the things are fairly predictable. What we saw was that our consumer confidence numbers took a tremendous tumble during the first decade of the 20th century. Well, duh. Yeah. That's not surprising, because the Michigan economy had a really rough...
21st century.
Did I say 20th?
Yes,
21st century, yeah. Yes.
How carefully do you parse the questions? Do you ever really get... Does it ever get to the what is the meaning of is level here in terms of exactly how to phrase a question?
Oh, we spend a great deal of time. Graham Pierce, the project manager, Linda Stork, who runs the call lab, she sometimes weighs in. Larry Hembroff is the director of the survey research office here at MSU. All of these folks, and I, we work with our clients... very carefully about the wording of the questions, because if we know anything about survey research, it is that small changes in the wording of the questions can lead to big changes in the results, and we want to get the true results, not the results that were dictated by the wording. It is both an art and a science. We worry about it a lot. One thing, remember, we're going for a random sample of the Michigan adult population. The Michigan adult population includes high school dropouts. We can't use extraordinarily sophisticated language, you know.
How does your poll differ then from polls involving likely voters?
We sometimes look at likely voters, but we don't ask that every time. In the run-up to the 2012 elections, we had a couple of surveys where we asked people questions about whether they were likely to be voters. But our main thing is not to ask what likely voters are thinking. Our main thing is to ask what is the general public, and we're often fairly agnostic about whether those people, those citizens, are likely to vote. Part of that is because, of course, people sometimes don't tell the truth about whether they're likely voters, and everybody who's involved in survey research knows that it's really tricky to sort all that out.
So we've run through economic attitudes, the president's numbers, the governor's numbers, right to work. Anything we've left out here?
Well, there's a lot more in the survey, but that was sponsored by clients, and they've got a six-month period during which they have exclusive use of their own numbers. So you may be hearing some more stuff. And next week, we're going to talk about trust in government and the most important issues facing the legislature and the governor. But for right now, the things that we've talked about this morning are the things that we've released so far.
And real quickly, Charlie, because we're just about out of time, where can people access the results of the survey?
If you just Google State of the State Survey, that'll get you there.
Very good. Director of the State of the State Survey, MSU Economics Professor Charlie Ballard. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Jazz singer Carolyn Lenhart will turn Wharton Center's Jackson Lounge into a jazz club next Wednesday. She'll be putting on two performances that night. This would be tonight, right? Tonight, to benefit East Lansing's Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. WKAR's Melissa Benmark caught up with her this week to ask what kinds of material she'll be performing at her Wharton gig.
You'll be hearing some music from my latest release, which is called Tides of Yesterday. And I'm a huge fan of Charles Mingus, so we'll probably do a song or two of his. We'll be doing some standards as well, you know, from the American Songbook, but things that I've rearranged, some originals. And then we'll probably do a song or two by Donald Fagen or Walter Becker of Steely Dan. I definitely don't do any of the hits. I'm so used to hearing them in their best forms. There's no reason to, you know, cover them. But they each have these little amazing nuggets they just don't ever do live. And one of the songs that they never even released. The one song that I recorded on my recent CD, which was a tune written by Donald alone, I think he wrote it for a soundtrack or something. It was like a demo for a soundtrack. I heard it and I loved it. And I not only did he give me permission to sing it, but I really wanted to change, like, rearrange the whole tune. So I said, can I take this, sing it, and can I, like, put it into, you know, 7/4? Would you let me totally reorchestrate it? He said, yeah, sure.
Since you left me, darling, the city doesn't feel right. On the street, the music stopped and the lights seem half as bright without your love. This old town's no fun at all.
I got very lucky and he loved the finished product, so that to me, letting me, you know, monkey around with his song was even more impressive to me that he gave me that artistic freedom than even letting me, you know, just sing it. But you know, it's really tricky when you're dealing with iconic voices such as Donald and also Walter Becker's. I mean, Walter isn't as well known for singing, but he's got an amazing sound and he's released some solo albums on his own. And you know, you got to be really careful when you start picking up music performed by people like that, you know, and thinking you can add something that's new or perhaps even better to it. That's you have to go into those moments very humbly.
Sure, sure. You do a lot of singing in clubs, it sounds like. And and for those of us who don't do that, we have this idea of this very intimate space and maybe a lot of regulars. And I'm just curious, what is club singing in 2013 really like?
Well, you know, the term club is so, it really depends on the club. I mean, the thing is, I grew up with my dad, who's a noted, you know, bassist and composer and singer-songwriter. His name is Jay Lenhart. And he's just has been and continues to be such a profound influence on me as a person, as an artist, if you're going to use that word. But even though he is a solo performer, he is also a brilliant sideman. And I really watched him when I was a child being a wonderful sideman. So I kind of have that mentality of I love my solo project, but I also love working with other groups when people call me and ask me to, you know, fit into their project and try something. So as a result, I feel really lucky that I get called to do that kind of a thing. And when I sing in clubs, it can be in a variety of circumstances. I mean, there's a club I perform in these days with this group. It's like a neo-soul group. And it's down on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, you know, and some nights there's tons of people there, some just listening. Sometimes there are just people hanging out drinking and, you know, it's complete background music. To me, the whole moment is fun. You know, I love making music in different incarnations and with different people. So that can go from really having the audience's attention to, you know, having people just walk through to go downstairs to another room or something. In the jazz clubs, obviously, people tend to sit down and on the whole be much more respectful. So that in that sense, you can take them on a journey more because you have their full attention. But, you know, I always feel like, listen, if it's always the places where you start feeling like, oh, nobody's listening and it doesn't really matter what I do, where, you know, someone will come up afterwards and say, oh my God, I never liked jazz and I just don't even like live music, but you sound amazing and you've just opened the world to me. So I've learned to never take any performing moment for granted, because just when you think no one's listening is when you might move someone the most, you know. So in that sense, it's really cool to go into all different kinds of clubs and see what happens, you know.
Carolyn Lenhart, thanks for joining us, and thanks for coming to East Lansing.
Thanks so much. I can't wait to get there.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. For today's Neighbors in Action segment, we feature Lap Respite Center in East Lansing. We've got a couple of guests from the center here today, but before we talk to them, we're going to give you a brief inside look at their organization. Current State's Kevin Lavery visited the center and has this report.
To find the office of Lap Respite Center in East Lansing, you have to drive a bit off the beaten path. It's tucked away in a low-rise brick building on the north side of Valley Court Park, sheltered from the faster pace of life along nearby Grand River Avenue. Here, peace and quiet is not just a perk, it's the point. Among other things, Lap Respite Center runs an in-house adult day program for the chronically ill and disabled. Executive Director John Stauffer says each person here has a behind-the-scenes caregiver who sometimes needs a little care themselves.
So by us taking that person on and coming and enjoying the services and the activities that we have here at ALFA, which stands for Active Living for Adults, we then give the primary care provider time off, quote, respite.
Some of the ALFA participants come just one day a week, others five. Not everyone here today was able to celebrate Easter at home, so the staff sees to it that their holiday does not go unobserved.
They just got done dyeing eggs. They were in here doing that, and now they're out here playing an egg game. So we're going to go out into the main room and see what activity they're working on right now.
About 15 people are gathered around a very long rectangular table. Their sport of choice, guess what's in the Easter egg.
What's in there? What do you think is in there? Shake it and listen to that. What could be in there?
While the game is underway, Stauffer takes me aside to show me a tray of cupcakes. Treats are a mainstay here, but this is a special occasion. Joe, a gentleman sitting at the end of the table, is turning 96 today. He's officially their oldest member.
And he's not really proud to have that title. He personally would rather be a little younger, if you ask him. but he's happy to be here and happy to be with us.
Okay. How about we have Joe open it up to see what it is?
30 years ago, Lap Respite Care started off simply as Lap, Lansing Area Parents. Local families looking for resources to support their disabled children couldn't find any, so they started their own. Today, Stauffer is encouraged that government is becoming more sensitive to the emotional well-being of providers. But giving care to caregivers is an idea that comes from the grassroots.
I can only hope that as a society we learn the value of caring for each other, and that by the time I reach Joe's age of 96, that there will be somebody there to be able to give the kind of services that we've given to him.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And here with us now in the Current State studio to tell us more about Lap Respite Center is Executive Director John Stauffer. Hi, John.
Good morning, Mark.
And he is joined by Nancy Gettler, who's been taking her son to Lap Respite Center for nearly 20 years. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there.
John, tell us a little bit more about Lap Respite Center. I understand you have an interesting beginning.
We certainly do. When people hear the word respite, they aren't always quite sure what that means. And in its simplest term, respite simply means short break. And there were a group of families in the Lansing area that had children with an assorted types of disabilities, and they needed that short break. And they band together trying to find resources for care for their children. They looked at the federal level, they looked at the state level, they looked at the local level. They were simply unable to find a pool of money or help from an organization, state or federally. So what they did was they started helping each other. They simply came together and said, well, if you'll watch my child on Tuesday so I can go to a parent-teacher conference, then I'll watch your child on Saturday so you can go to the soccer game with your other children. And they literally did that for 4 or 5 years. At that point, they were able to land a fairly substantial federal grant, and that allowed them to bring on an executive director, Judy Wagner, and she was their executive director for 22 and a half years. She helped grow this organization. and they were able to become a 501c3 nonprofit. And at that time, they changed their name from Lansing Area Parents Respite Center simply to LAP Respite Center.
There has been growing awareness, it seems to me, of this notion of giving caregivers a break. But it sounds like, do you feel like you were at the cutting edge of this idea?
Absolutely, Mark. I think that back in the 70s and 80s, this was just starting to come about. And it truly is a grassroots effort. The government's just starting to understand the implications of families and the dynamics of what happens when you're having to care for someone who needs 24/7 care, mm-hmm. and the impact that that makes on the community, the impact that makes on that family when a mom has to stay home from work because she's got to care for somebody 24/7.
Nancy Gettler, you've been taking your son to LAP for nearly 20 years. Tell us about him. Tell us about your experience at LAP.
Well, we're transplanted here from the Chicago area. Well, actually from Minneapolis by way of Chicago area. But when we came here, we had an 8-year-old son with cerebral palsy, severely brain damaged, 2 required, lots of physical care and a wheelchair and feeding and those kind of needs. And I was looking for somebody that could just help me out for those very reasons that John said, school conferences, maybe taking a bike ride with my other children, maybe a short overnight trip somewhere. And I was given the name of LAP, and it was just a godsend, and I've been with them ever since. And that has progressed to weekends. We have a respite house where we can take our son for a weekend, so that recently I had to go see my aging mother, and I used to take him along with me but can't anymore. So that provided me an opportunity to leave town for the weekend, and my son enjoys those weekends. He's with kids his own age or other. There's lots of activities going on that are fun, and it allows me great peace of mind because I could not have a neighbor or a relative come in and take care of him for
You're a member of that generation that worries about their parents and their kids.
Yes, I am.
Right, there's a lot of us out there
yes.
right now. Tell us a little bit more here about your experience raising your son, though. How many kids do you have?
I have 3.
3.
And he's the oldest.
Okay.
So, and, you know, you get so used to it that you don't even realize that it's different, but for years, my husband and I, and still really only go out one at a time, one person at a time, to different events because our son is difficult to take along. Now, when he was little, it wasn't so difficult, but now it requires a van and a lift, and the wheelchair is big and doesn't go places easily, and special feedings. And although we love him and he's delightful and it's wonderful taking care of him, just having those little brief respites makes it so much easier.
I am sure. John, how do people find you? How do they get connected to LAP?
Well, I'm working hard on that right now, Mark, but one of the best ways to find us is through our website, which is simply laprespitecenter.org. We're in the senior preferences guide that is posted in a lot of community buildings across a Tri-County area. You can also contact us directly. We're in the phone book, so 372-6671. You can call. Most of the people who use our services sometimes come to us indirectly through either Tri-County Office on Aging when we're working with our senior population, or through community mental health most of the times when we're working with our children. But we're happy to have them contact us directly. They can call us. But the best thing, I love the internet, that Googling is easy. If you Google LAP Respite Center, you'll find us.
What is one of the more, from your perspective with the organization, is there a memorable encounter that comes to mind?
We get touched daily. I have the most wonderful job in the world in that I get to oversee a bunch of professional, trained individuals who are passionate and compassionate and tender and understanding, that go into these families and allow them to operate as well as they can as a family unit. And it's just a wonderful experience to be able to hear those care providers come and share with me stories and events that have happened. I think probably the best story that I can think of right now is a story of a young man whose mom thought that he would never be able to feed himself. And our care providers, because we're there a lot with them and have the time to do that, were able to work with him over a course of several months and get him to first hang on to something, because first whenever anything went to his hand, he would just throw it. And he learned to hang on to something. Well, what do you normally feed somebody? A Cheerio or a Fruit Loop, something like that? Once he gets that, like a baby, where does that go once it gets into the hand and it stays there? First place it goes is right into the mouth. So once we got him to hang on to his hand, we were able to get him to take that from his hand to his mouth. And then we were able to get him to hang on to like a spoon. So we've actually, over the last 6 months, the first 6 months that I was actually here at Lap Respite Center, was one of the most touching stories to me, because we were able to do something for that family and for that mom that she thought was never going to happen. Mm.
And she saw it happen. Yes. It unfolded. You rely heavily on volunteers?
Not so much, because our training is so specific that we have to do, because of the disabilities that we're dealing with, because of the illnesses that we're dealing with. We can use volunteers at the adult daycare program, because that's a group setting. But a lot of our work is done one-on-one with these families and these individuals, and without some specific training, volunteers are not probably the best use for the causes of what we do.
Nancy Gettler, is there a bond among parents of special needs children? I imagine there is.
Oh, yes. We all, you know, feel each other's pain, sort of, but and share the information we have about LAP and share the information that we have about whatever services are available, but there really is a bond. And there's a bond with the workers, too, the care providers that come into our house that really, truly know how to take care of our children, put a whole new spin on care, because you get sort of used to your mundane, everyday tasks. And when you have somebody new and enthusiastic come in the house, it gives you a bright, fresh look at your child. It makes you refreshed and, you know, oh, gee, he really is kind of a fun guy to hang out with, you know.
John, how do people get involved with the organization, and what kinds of folks are you looking for?
That's great. And just a quick follow-up, Mark, on what you said, where it came to me as I was talking, one of the ways where we could use a volunteer is if you have somebody that we're touching their heart with the story that we're telling here, if they have a skill set, if they were an artist, if they're a musician, we could have them come to our respite house and entertain the children that are staying there for the weekend. They couldn't provide the care, but they could certainly enhance their life in that weekend. So if there was somebody who wanted to contact us that had a skill set that they would like to share with the folks we work with, that would be awesome.
Right.
As far as reaching us and those folks who tend to work with us, about 70% of our care providers are Michigan State students. They have to go through it's a 3-day full 8-hour day course, some on-the-job training at our respite house and our after-school program, and they also have to do on-the-job training in the home usually. Nancy's son, for instance, needs some specific kind of care. We would not have somebody work with that child until she's had the chance to work with them to make sure they understand what they're supposed to be doing.
We're just about out of time, but tell us about your event quickly, please.
Thank you very much, Mark. On the 19th of April, we have one fundraiser a year, and it's called Like a Fine Wine, LAP Only Gets Better with Time. It's going to be held at Lou and Harry's on Chandler Road. Tickets are $120 for two or one for $75. It is a strolling food and wine pairing. We have a dozen wines. We have food that's to knock your socks off. The Peter Nelson Quartet will be there. It's a jazz group that's local. You can Google Peter Nelson and you'll find some great information on the music that he plays. The food is off the charts. We'll have a live and silent auction. It all goes to support the causes that we've talked about today. And I really hope that you take the time to look at us at www.laprespitecenter.org, and you can find out more about the event.
John Stauffer is the executive director of LAP Respite Center. Nancy Gettler's been using LAP to care for her son for nearly 20 years. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
MSU's G. Robert Vincent Voice Library is now home to the largest collection of interviews with North and South Americans who survived the bombings in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The collection was brought to MSU in part because of Dr. Noko Wake. Wake, who teaches in both MSU's Lyman Briggs College and the History Department, joined current state's Emmanuel Berry to discuss how the interviews came to be at Michigan State.
It all started out when I myself was interested in doing some research work about American survivors of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II in 1945. And I just came across with this piece of information that suggests that there are some substantial number of American-born American citizens who were victimized by the bomb because they happened to be either in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And there were children of immigrants who came to the States even before the war was on the horizon. And in the process of my work, I came across was this newspaper article, actually, that reported on Shinpei Takeda, who is the Japanese filmmaker currently located in Tijuana in Mexico. And and I realized that he's making a documentary film. And so for that purpose, he was interviewing South American survivors of the bomb. And I just realized that, you know what, I really have to get a hold of this person and talk to this person to see if we can learn from each other. And that's how all the conversation started.
So these interviews are with survivors who aren't in Japan. We typically, you know, think of survivors as living in Japan, and it's kind of this contained thing.
Right.
What does it mean, you know, to think outside and to hear the stories of these people who have, you know, crossed borders, and it's more of an international story, I guess.
Right, right. So I guess it really teaches us a lot in terms of how, when we think about the bomb, we think about national conflict. Japan was fighting against America. America was fighting against Japan. And there are some strong sentiments that goes into that. And also when we think about survivors of the bomb or victims of the bomb, we tend to think about Japanese nationals because that kind of fits right into this image of war against each other between nation states. But if you listen to Japanese Americans' experiences and memories of the bomb, it really contradicts the simplistic views of the war and the use of the bomb because they actually kind of belong to both America and Japan. And because of that connections, their memories of the bomb is not necessarily really bound by what we tend to think about the bomb when we think of that as a result of war against each other. So that's very fascinating materials.
Many of the other survivors in the bomb in the U.S. initially were kind of afraid to talk about it or little bit shy about sharing their story, which might be in part too, you know, that being American at heart, but at the same time being Japanese and that kind of internal conflict. I guess talk a little bit more about why they might have been afraid and why, you know, they finally decided to come forward and share this.
Mm-hmm. I think their kind of transnational experience or international identity really didn't have easy place to fit into in the post-war American society. So the Cold War was going on. America was fighting against Soviet Union, and there was a competition between democracy and communism and so forth. And within that context, America considered it to be really important to have Japanese as a new ally in international political context. And if you think about that, the history, very troubled and complex history of Japanese Americans who were victimized by the weapon that their own government used against its own citizens because they happened to be in Japan during the wartime, it's very difficult to kind of fit that old story into this Cold War context. So that's a larger picture that I can immediately think about when I think about the reason why many people didn't want to talk about it. And another thing is that there are many of their family members, Japanese Americans, who were in America during World War II. and placed in relocation camps. There are many Japanese Americans on the West Coast who were interned in those camps. And when they got together with their family members who were bombed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the war was over, many people found it really difficult to talk to each other about their own experiences because they both suffered and they were victimized in some ways, but in different ways as mm-hmm. well. So how did you actually share that kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, how is it that they ended yeah. up coming forward?
Right,
yeah.
right. So there is this more intimate family context that made it really difficult for people to talk. And another thing I really want to emphasize is that there was a longstanding prejudice against survivors of the bomb, no matter what the nationality may be, because they were considered to be, you know, susceptible to bomb illnesses. They look all right now, but maybe in 5 years they would have a cancer. Mm-hmm. Or there is even a prejudice actually held by many medical professionals of the 1950s that kind of made people believe that if you even come close to a person irradiated by the bomb, you will get that bomb illness as well. So don't even... you know, come treat them.
So the stigma kind right. of holding people back. And that's something that that continues throughout the interviews, this kind of health and health issues and right. illness around. And one of the interviews that we had that is in the collection, it has the Carpenters, it's a husband and wife pair. The husband is American. The wife is a Japanese person who survived the bomb. And they talk a little bit about how there seems to be a sense of ambiguity around
exactly.
these health issues and how professionals don't really want to address that. So this is Lonnie Carpenter. He's an American. Once again, his wife was a survivor. And this is him talking about his wife's experience with doctors.
My feeling, a true feeling is the doctors think, well, yeah, something's wrong, but we don't know what it is, and we can't say it's associated with the atomic bomb. And they just kind of set that aside. So when you start talking about, could you please write me a report about this for how it might be associated with the atomic bomb, would they just, they wash their hands of it, and they don't want to have anything to do with it.
So why is there that kind of attitude around this, and even today, and why are medical professionals so eager to step away from it, to not acknowledge it?
I wouldn't say, you know, American doctors today would be unwilling to, you know, treat bomb-related illnesses. And it was more of a historical issue that we are looking at here. But I would say case by case, we have to take a careful look of it. And maybe in some cases, there would be still a sort of discomfort on the part of American doctors to see a person who was victimized by the weapon that his or her own country used. So there is a little bit of emotional issues that may be involved in that. But I think in addition to that, what we need to think about is a sort of professional concern of not being able to tell, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think it's really difficult medically and statistically speaking to tell if a cancer that a person suffers from is indeed caused by the bomb. Or maybe not, because many people suffer from cancer anyway, regardless of their experiences. So it's not as though there is a clear rocket science behind it. And I think, you know, many medical professionals like to be helpful and be knowledgeable about what they're doing, but this is a kind of issue that doesn't make it easy for medical professionals. And in addition to that, I think it's simply a lack of accumulation of data that would help doctors to actually do a research on this. And sure, ever since the war was over, I think as early as 1946, American government, in collaboration with Japanese government, created a research institute in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, started to collect medical data to study the impact of radiation among bomb survivors in those two cities. But even with that data, it's not really clear so exactly what conditions can be mm-hmm. Statistically and medically related to the radiation. So I think it's, in a way, understandable that medical doctors are not particularly eager to deal with this issue.
And I think another point or another aspect that this idea of, you know, this fear or not to fear these different kind of decisions is the idea that of time, that this bomb isn't going away, that there are still these lingering
right.
after effects. And I think that's something that Lonnie also gets at in his interview.
What is atomic bomb to you? Also to you.
Okay. The atomic bomb to me is destruction in a very small package. It can do so much damage, and it's something so small, and it can just destroy so much. Not only will it blow all the houses up, it'll leave millions and millions of people with radiation problems, which takes years and years and years and years. It takes hundreds of years to correct. You can't correct it. Look at this. Now we're talking about something that happened 45, 60 years ago. And just like you said, second, third generation, still having problems.
Historically, why is it important to understand kind of, I guess, these lasting effects or take note of the fact that these effects, that it's still affecting people, that it's still a prevalent part of people's lives today?
Yeah, I think one thing that stories like Lonely Carpenters tells us so compellingly is that when we think about the bomb, we kind of tend to think about two big things. One is that, oh, maybe that's not such a great thing for a human society to have such a thing because yeah. it's about destruction and killing. And the second thing, though, is that this is all related to countries fighting against or competing against each other. That's the reason why countries, many of them, decided to make them and maintain them. But then that's really the bomb as being perceived by the perception of or the point of view of the powerful or political leaders or people who want to make those technologies available for whatever benefit that they see in it. But people like Ronnie Carpenter and Sue Carpenter, who is a survivor, who is Ronnie's wife, really tells us or urges us to think about things like bomb from the perspective of people who were actually affected by it. And individual lives are oftentimes, it could be seen as small or tiny, insignificant, but those are the people who have to live with the consequences throughout their lives, and maybe they're even children generations. And I think it's really the kind of thing that should give us a pause and a think about, okay, so we tend to want to have the immediate benefit. Create a bomb and then make the country strong and powerful. That sounds like an immediate good thing that we can get out of this. But if you look at perception of people like Ronnie or Sue's, we get an entirely different understanding of what it means to us humans collectively. So I think that's one big significance that I hope we can hear from stories like that.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insight with us. Nako Wakhe is an assistant professor in Lyman Briggs College and the Department of History at Michigan State University. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll take a quick look back at the Spartan men's basketball season and other things. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by City Pulse, which this week examines the tension between conservationists and the Snyder administration over how to safeguard the environment, on newsstands or at LansingCityPulse.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.